Hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, the independent media-focused podcast that brings you all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
Esther, who did you talk to this week?
A very exciting guest. This week I spoke to Nicholas Thompson, who is the editor-in-chief of Wired. So we talked about their positioning as a tech magazine in the digital world, the impact of their two huge Facebook features, the last one of which came out a couple of weeks ago, as well as what his dream paywall would look like. We'll also be releasing a couple of snippets of bonus audio on our social channels throughout the week, so follow us at Media Voices Pod for more.
We'd also like to take this time to let you know that we're going to be releasing a special episode this week, the second in our conversation series. So this week, we've got Katie Vanning-Smith, co-founder of slow journalism publisher Tortoise, in a room with Michael Silberman, who is SVP of Strategy at Piano. And they have an exhaustive chat about subscriptions, memberships, and ultimately what will make people pay for the news. And I'm in the room as well. So do keep an ear out for that, which is coming out sometime this week. Before that, though, as ever, the news roundup. And sort of the biggest news broke, was it yesterday, which was Friday as we record this, which is that TI Media has sold music titles Enemy and Uncut to the social music platform BandLab Technologies. So Singapore-based BandLab also purchased Guitar Magazine and Music Tech from Anthem Publishing last year. So it really seems like they're building up a strong portfolio of those titles that, Peter, you like to think of as having fanatical and dedicated fan bases.
Well, they definitely do. I don't know BandLab. I don't know them at all. I don't make music, so that's where they're coming from.
Well, and they're based in Singapore.
Oh, and I guess they're international. They just happen to be based in Singapore. People, as you will eventually see from my reaction to this, people get very passionate about music.
Yeah, a little bit.
So if you can corral that audience, whether that's, you know, music techs or guitar players or people that listen to particular bands. Yeah, absolutely. So it's probably a good thing for BandLab.
Oh, I think it is. That's the thing. I think it's a very smart content play for them because it's going to get people to remain on their platform. It's similar to what Ultimate Guitar did. You know, they provide tabs for, you know, people who are playing guitar, bass, and then a couple of other instruments, but they also have a strong news section. And even though I'm not particularly into music news, I do spend a lot more time on that platform because they have this news coming up about my favourite bands.
There you go. What the fuck's it going to do to NME, though?
Based on the Press Gazette news roundup, it sounds like everybody is currently staying where they are in terms of staff.
Well, they're even staying in the same building, weirdly.
That's a great building, actually. The Bluefin building's really nice. I don't know. This is a weird one. I totally get it from a business point of view. I can understand why TI Media is selling these titles.
Can you? Why?
How can I say this without sounding like a dick? They don't care. They're not making anything from them.
But I thought NME was doing really, like, since going digital, it was on the up and up again.
Synergy with their other...
So this is where... Okay, let's kick into this properly. This is where I get to sound like the old punk rocker.
Peter!
In the corner of the pub. These titles were part of my fucking childhood, my youth. Not Uncut particularly. I never really liked Uncut, but NME, absolutely. And, you know, Marcus Richards, they had a special place in our story. Yay! But, you know, the underlying message there, not specifically from Marcus, but in the industry terms, is they had a special place in our story, but they're done. And we're so chuffed that we can actually offload them and get some cash. there's a line in that release where he says they're better placed with a business that has music at its heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe there's an argument there, but wouldn't it be better if they were in a business that had magazines or publishing at their heart?
Yeah, it's existing at a business that has the format at their heart better than existing at one that has the subject at their heart.
Well, I don't know. I think if you look at a lot of, especially a lot of the branded content titles that have launched over the last couple of years, that they do well because that the company that publishes them, yes, they may not have publishing at their heart, but they know the audience really, really well, and it then just becomes like an extension.
That's an interesting point. That definitely is an interesting point. But how many of those brands are actually going to proper magazine publishers to deliver? Do you know what I mean? So, like, was it Gwyneth Paltrow went to Hearst?
Yeah, that's a bad example. Like Airbnb went to Hearst as well, but I think if they're going to be in the same building and they're going to be surrounded by the same people, I bet, you know, they'll probably still use the same printer for Uncut. How much is actually going to change in terms of the print expertise and the magazine expertise?
Hey, Essa gets to be the optimist for this one.
Well, honestly, it sounds like it might be quite a necessary injection of cash. You know, NME went online only last year in the face of kind of ongoing losses. So it needs something to kind of boost its profile digitally. And honestly, BandLab might be the people to do that.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to shut up now.
Why, are you not going to go off on another punk rocker diatribe like you did last time?
Gina was a punk rocker. No, you know what? You've actually... You haven't made me change my mind on this because I'm still so pissed off that NME's dying on its arse.
Petey, you've got to let go of the fact that Rihanna was on the cover.
Yeah, I can't get past it. Do you know what? There's a bunch of people who have still got their jobs and they're going to be doing pretty much what they love, and God bless them, and I hope I really hope this works. I always say that. I really hope this works.
Moving on then. Quartz is the latest publisher to put up a paywall. It's going to cost $100 a year. It's got a variable metered paywall, so averaging 10 free, but that depends on the prospect. And some articles are going to be members only, in line with the membership scheme that launched last November. And when this news broke, I saw a lot of people sort of decrying it as being, you know, Quartz built their reputation on the back of these very premium ads that booked the trends around sort of programmatic and, you know, low CPMs and everything, because they were doing some really smart things with advertising. So if Quartz can go behind a paywall, the question people seem to be asking is there anybody who won't at this point? Is there anybody who can sustain themselves through advertising?
Do you know what surprised me at this point was very few people were actually talking about it.
Mm.
So I caught it in a newsletter that happened to pass, and I thought, oh, you know, there's going to be loads of, you know, opinion pieces or whatever on it. And then everybody just kind of was like, yeah, okay, fine, shrugged their shoulders and moved on. It was a little bit like, I mean, yeah, even the piece that, I think the Neiman Lab piece, which we'll link to because it's always brilliant,
mm-hmm.
Even that said, you know, just kind of, the news landed and it didn't really, like, barely anybody noticed.
I think it would have landed better if this was the first paid-for product that they launched. But they're, you know, they've been trialing direct revenue for quite a while between its paid for esports section or its cryptocurrency newsletter or this membership scheme.
Well, the membership scheme is actually launched, in November?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they've always had a selection of articles behind for that, just for that membership group already.
I think that's a real change in emphasis, though. It used to be pay as and get more. Now it's pay as. I can see definitely why, looking at that Neiman Lab piece, why they're doing this. Their traffic, which they'd introduced programmatic as well as those big, you know, custom ads.
Yep.
And the traffic was dropping, so they've definitely lost revenue on that side.
Well, I think it was as soon as, is it Userbase?
Userbase.
The Japanese company, yeah.
Yeah.
As soon as they bought them, that almost seemed to signal the intentions, because Userbase sort of has a lot of experience in the business news service. And I can remember the press releases as soon as they were bought, people saying, oh, well, that's it, you know, Quartz is going to get a paywall, it's going to go down that paid content route. But I didn't expect its traffic to drop quite that much.
I think they're no strangers to that, though. If you remember way back in the day, I think it was they got a lot of referral traffic from either Facebook or LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And one day they just turned the spigot and, you know, they had almost a crisis on their hands.
Well, their whole thing was that when they launched, seven years ago?
A while ago.
They were, you know, the whole thing was that mobile first, free, open web. The design was intense. It was amazing on the mobile. They did a lot of really cool stuff.
They have launched a lot of products that have gone to sort of become industry standard. They just happened to be ahead of the curve on them.
We were talking about them. It was the innovation stuff, and they peaked, not with innovation, but with traffic. They peaked like 2017.
I don't know.
Are you disappointed, Chris?
No, not at all. I think, for one thing, paywalls now and actually onboarding people is a lot more sophisticated than it used to be. I'm not disappointed. I think this is a smart play for an organization that has this reputation and has launched paid for products before. Yeah, I don't know. I would be surprised if people were disappointed, to be honest.
Also, just a little spoiler for later on, Nick does give his opinion on the Quartz paywall and, yeah, kind of the paywall play and strategies.
Oh my God, we should have listened to that first and then we would have found it really smart.
Well, no, I don't want to give it away.
I mean, what do you guys think? Is 10 articles, even with that flexibility, is 10 articles the right amount for what has become a sort of more general news site, or almost a lifestyle news site?
My initial reaction was it's too much.
I mean, I guess the thing is that because this is a little bit flexible, isn't it? Some people have hit it after 7, some people have hit it after 14.
Yeah.
And I guess they will play around with that data, and if 10 is too much, they will presumably reduce it. Like The Economist used to have sort of 10 free, and they've reduced that to like 2 paragraphs now.
I was going to say, I don't know of anybody who's become more liberal with their paywall stuff. I suspect that this is almost an introductory 10 articles, and they will eventually tighten up. Well, The Sun, yeah, obviously, but that was when they went, fuck, people won't pay for this shit. I suppose
be interesting to see how it goes.
Yeah, and ultimately it will be down to execution as well. So presumably that, you know, 10 articles currently limit before you hit the paywall is based on all the smart propensity modeling that they've been able to do. And actually, in the conversation special that we're going to be putting out this week, I have a really good conversation with Michael Silverman about exactly that, about how sophisticated propensity modeling can get now. But I think... Yes, we can now go live to Scotland, where I believe our special correspondent Peter is on the ground in what is effectively one of the biggest constitutional crises that the country's ever seen.
Absolutely. I have driven all the way to Scotland this weekend. I'm reporting on the sausage scandal.
Sorry, a perfect scandal?
Sausage. So anyway, I've come up here in a city called Glasgow. To report on a perfect parable of cultural appropriation fueled by churnalism and a shocking lack of diversity in the newsroom in this time of fake news.
Okay, oh, holy shit, this sounds like the most important story we have ever reported on.
Absolutely.
Why don't you take us through it?
This is what I get out of bed for.
So Aldi has claimed to make breakfast easier for a genius reason which was explained in the Daily Star. And what the genius thing that they've done is make sausages square. That's why it's called sausage, because the edge is in the bread. Yeah. So that's genius.
That is genius.
Problem is, it's been a thing in Scotland for freaking centuries. It's gone mental. Best one that I saw was, because I know this is Esther's favourite word, favourite Scottish word, they're called long sausages, you absolute ball bags.
That's only because the transcription thing had absolutely no idea what you were talking about.
And it won't again. So they're actually, I'm obviously taking a piss, but there is a serious point in this.
No, there isn't.
Don't just print a fucking press release because Aldi sends it to you. And if you're going to do that, or worse, if it's paid content, check your facts. Because you're basically putting your clients in a position of having to defend themselves against their biggest competitors, in this case Lidl, who's royally taking the piss out of Aldi.
Are they really?
Yeah.
What, just sort of saying?
There was that, one of the tweets I saw was, breaking news, Aldi's also invented Iron Brew, haggis and something else.
I mean, it's unsurprising that it's come out of, you know, the Star. Perhaps they have a reputation for sensationalism and sort of, let's say, not as exhaustive research as you would like. Don't just print PR stories. It's exacerbated by the fact that, you know, I was talking to people this week about this. There are now 6 PR people to every one journalist. And at a place that relies on that journalism, you're going to have situations like this happen more often than not now.
I mean, I know the Star's not necessarily a bastion of fact-checking or whatever.
I can't believe I've heard both the words churnalism and sauce edge in one morning.
What about
ball bags?
Bastions and ball bags.
So this week in brief, Pinterest shares have fallen 15% after first quarter earnings were reported. The company has had larger than expected losses, which, given the fact that I don't even remember Pinterest, isn't surprising.
It did beat its revenue. It did beat its revenue earnings, though.
Who uses
Pinterest?
Me? I love Pinterest. Where else do you get like recipes and dresses and shoes and wallpaper inspiration?
Right.
Condé has sold Brides magazine to Dot Dash, which has said straight away it's scrapping the print magazines, but is keeping most of the editorial staff.
And always my favourite thing to be announcing, Spotify is launching Stories.
Hooray!
They're doing some weird thing called Storyline, which is like designed to be an insight into musicians' lives. But just stop with the stories, people, please.
Food vertical Twisted, which launched a delivery-only restaurant called Twisted London, is expanding to a further 5 branches in London in a really weird publisher-turns restaurant twist. Oh, get it? Twisted.
And 17 Magazine has brought out its first special issue since canning the print magazine last year. What's the special issue about?
It's themed on going to college and getting ready to pack up and go.
That makes sense. That's interesting. That's similar to what Vice were doing with, you know, they're building a brand now around adulting content.
Adulting.
Mm-hmm. Rather teaching people how to be adults.
And that's really interesting, though, because I did this thing at Roehampton this week, and it was the students pitching. There was 5 student magazines, and the teams pitched their magazines to a panel of judges, and one of them was about adulting.
In what way? Like taxes? Or
yeah, how to plan careers, how to figure out your student loan, how to basically be a grown-up. It was actually a great day. It was, they had an ethical vegan one. They had one about alternative views of beauty, one about a kind of immigrant view of London. Oh, one was mental. It was about celebrity-styled handbag dogs.
What?
It was really
specifically
good.
Around the dogs.
Yeah, it was inspired by like real Housewives of Cheshire or whatever. It was nuts, but it was actually really well put together. It was a great day. The students at Roehampton are fantastic.
Nice.
And you know, so is Ali Warner, massive fan of the podcast. I'm now a massive fan of her university.
So we have a growing transcript section on our website, thanks to a clever AI transcription tool from Trent. So you can go to voices.media/transcripts to see them all. So that's transcripts of all the guests that we've had. And there's also a link to our dedicated email list that sends them out every Monday. So go and sign up.
So this week I spoke to Wired's editor-in-chief, Nicholas Thompson. I started by asking him how Wired is now positioned in a world where the lines between technology, business, culture and politics are blurring.
That's such a good question, and it gets at the heart of what Wired is. When Wired started, tech was a much narrower thing, and then tech got embedded in everything. And so the way we had to think about what we cover and what our space in the world changed constantly. At points we thought about ourselves as, well, we can write about any story we want, as long as we write about the tech part of it, right? We can write about any company we want as long as we write about their email server. We can write about any cultural figure we want as long as we write about their digital strategy. There are other moments where the way we've thought about tech stories have been, well, let's look at problems the way engineers look at problems. Let's look at the world the way people in tech look at the world. And the way I try to define it is that Wired is a magazine about the forces disrupting the world and changing the world. And so what we try to do is we try to identify the most disruptive forces on our economy, on what it means to be human, and we write about them. So if you were to take a look at all the stories we've published in the 2 years that I've been the editor, you would see, for example, a lot of stories about CRISPR, but not a lot of stories about basic science. And the reason we write about CRISPR is because we want to write about science, but we also want to write about the parts of science that we think are changing what it means to be human, changing the way we exist in the world. So we identify those things and then dive into them.
And you said just then that you're aiming to be a magazine. What does a tech magazine look like today?
That's a great, that's a funny question. Yeah, it is true. We are one of the things I like to think about is that we're, you know, journalism is obviously a troubled industry right now, but because we cover the forces that are destroying our industry, we are hedged. So the faster the acceleration goes, the better our story is. But more seriously, we publish a magazine because there are wonderful things about publishing a print magazine. There are wonderful things about the United States Postal Service, International Postal Service, getting something printed on paper that you can read. But the majority of our efforts are obviously focused towards digital. And one of the great things about Wired is that we made the digital transition that so many journalistic entities have struggled with. You know, we made that 15 years ago. We started, you know, 10 years ago at least, started bringing down the walls between the digital operation and the print operation.
Yeah, because I can remember, I think you guys have had some quite innovative digital magazines over the years, sort of when digital magazines were cool.
Yeah, I think the Wired iPad edition, when the iPad came out, let's say 2009, 2010, just killed it. It was so beautiful, so crazy. The design was amazing. Of course, it was, 100 megabytes, and you couldn't put the darn thing on your iPad, and people didn't adopt that form of magazine reading the way that so many people, ourselves included, expected, but incredibly innovative. Our forms of, long-form multimedia storytelling were also extremely innovative. So, we feel some obligation to use the most innovative tools coming from the world we cover.
And talking of a lot of your kind of editorial angles, I think the thing the journalism world has known you for, particularly over the last couple of years, has been these, your what was it, 11,000 word pieces on Facebook. I think there was Inside the Tears that shook Facebook with that cover of Zuckerberg with a black eye. You've just followed it up with 15 months of fresh hell. So what kind of drove the decision to do those two pieces?
Sure. So, as the editor-in-chief, I don't have a ton of time to write. I shouldn't take a ton of time to write. But I do care a lot personally and specifically about certain issues. And I do know a decent amount, personally and specifically about certain issues. And one of them is Facebook and the way the Facebook algorithm has affected the news industry and the way the Facebook algorithm has affected democracy. And so after the 2016 election, it was clear in the United States that Facebook had played a substantial role and a very, very interesting role. And that, in fact, the way that Facebook had disrupted the news industry was connected to the way that they had disrupted politics. And so I have a friend who's on staff who I co-wrote a piece with 10 years ago, and he's still here, Fred Vogelstein. And so he and I were kicking around how to cover Facebook, and we said, well, why don't we write a big story, the two of us, and we'll split it apart, and we'll each take on different parts and talk to different people, and we'll try to reconstruct the full story of the 2016 election and its aftermath. What happened leading up to the election? Why was Facebook so blind to the Russian interference, to all the fake news problems? What was happening with the news industry, that fraught relationship? How did Facebook respond after the election? So we wrote that piece. It came out in January of 2018, and then, as people noticed, Facebook had a really interesting year even after that. Our first story was called Inside the 2 Years That Shook Facebook and the World. And so we spent the next year watching, catastrophe, chaos, excitement, frustration, building at Facebook, explosions everywhere. And of course, we know all the characters because we talked to, 50 people the first time around. We know everybody in executive management. We know lots of people at the lower levels of the organization. And so in about, I would say, October, November, Fred and I said, we should probably do it again. And so I started calling. I made up a list of all of the, the 15 things I didn't understand about Facebook that I wanted to try to understand. And we started asking people. And we tried to put together a chronological narrative of, the 15 months from when our first story published to when our second story published. So to the larger question of why did I do that, it's one of the biggest stories in the world. It was something I knew a lot about. And even though I've got lots to do in my job, I do love writing and reporting. I did have, long, far-ranging conversations with other executives without any comms officials in the room.
Do you think any of them kind of grasp some of the problems that have actually created now rather than just trying to bat it away with PR?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt that they know that they have created problems. I mean, if I were to give the most honest and charitable construction I can of how a senior executive at Facebook thinks, they would probably think, we did make mistakes, we did prioritize growth over other values, we did resolve trade-offs in ways that weren't the smartest, we absolutely screwed up in 2016, but at the same time, the media is totally unfair. The media doesn't understand it. The public doesn't understand the complexity of this. And these problems are way harder than people think. And all of that is partially true. But I think that is genuinely the narrative that would go on in the minds of a top Facebook exec.
Yeah, it's just grown almost out of control.
It's grown almost out of control. And it's, I was thinking about this yesterday where, one of the most interesting trade-offs that Facebook has to deal with is the trade-off between privacy and safety. The more you prioritize privacy, the more bad things happen on your platform and maybe out in the world, but the more people's identities are protected. The more you prioritize safety, the more the company becomes like Big Brother. And so there were two big news stories yesterday, right, that came up in Facebook land. So number one was Facebook, moving to a one-strike policy on Facebook live streaming for people who violate their policies, which means if you post one picture that their algorithms identify as nude or hate speech, you won't be able to post live videos. That's a response into the Christchurch shooting. And everybody was like, that's really good, you know, prioritizing safety. But it's also kind of a issue with privacy there. And then simultaneously, there's a big debate in San Francisco about face recognition technology. And my whole Twitter feed / filter bubble is totally in favor of not allowing, certainly police departments use face recognition, but probably not allowing Facebook either. But again, that's a situation where you're prioritizing privacy over safety. So there are two big stories. My filter bubble, or all the people inside of my filter bubble agitated, or inside my Twitter feed, are arguing opposite sides without quite kind of realizing it. And that's the situation that Facebook is in, is that they're often trying to prioritize between these really hard things, and they know they're going to get slammed no matter what side they choose. That's not to exonerate them, because they often choose the wrong side, right? And they often choose the side that will advantage their business model, and they couch it in other terms. But it is to say that being a tech platform with the responsibilities that they have is hard. And so that's part of the reason why I like writing about it so much, is because it's what's at stake is immense, and the choices aren't easy. And anybody who thinks the choices are easy is not looking quite hard enough.
Could you ever kind of see like a future utopia where both sides are balanced and we actually end up getting past this as a society?
Maybe. The question that I struggle with, and I don't know the answer to, is this fixable, right? I think that Facebook does lots of good in society, connects people in ways that are good. I think that Twitter connects people in ways that are good. But I think that Twitter certainly has been a real harm to the way politics and democracy function. There are lots of benefits. And so could you fix it? Could you change the algorithms? Could you change the structure? Or is it too late? You know, Facebook, could you change it so that it's unambiguously a net benefit? I think so. I think you can change the algorithms. I think you can change the philosophy. I think you can change the structures.
I mean, that comes down to the internet itself. Could you ever get the internet so that it's net positive?
Yeah, that I definitely think you can.
Right.
Can you get people? Yes. That I definitely believe. I absolutely believe that the internet as a whole can be net positive. The question is whether the question where I'm more undecided are on the platforms. Is the world better off with a different Twitter or no Twitter? And I still feel like it's a different Twitter, but that's a hard one.
But anyway, if we get back to those pieces themselves, what was the kind of impact of them both, I guess, in terms of metrics to you guys? And also, I think like, there was a cultural and political impact.
Yeah, so they both, they both got, but it's certainly over 1 million readers. The first one's over 2 million. The first story was the top driver of subscriptions last year. You know, we drove 108,000 subscriptions with our first year with a paywall. I mean, I know the story that drove the most was our first Facebook story. So there were lots of people who read them, I mean, in part because it's, you know, the 12,000-word story about the biggest thing of the year. And as all the catastrophes happened at Facebook through following our story, not because of our story, but following our story, people would link back and read our story again. So they had a wonderful long tail. So they were terrific. This first story has had a big effect. Now, the political impact of the stories, that's hard to measure, right? You could say, oh, this was one of the first times that people from Facebook talked. It was one of the first big investigations in a magazine. The fact that it came in Wired had a big influence. Maybe. But you can also say, like, the thing that really cracked the dam was Cambridge Analytica scandal that happened 2 months after our story. That certainly shook up Facebook in a way nothing else did. So there was a lot going on at the company. It's hard to say how much our story mattered. The thing I can say is that I do genuinely believe that if you want to understand Facebook, we've written the most comprehensible, clearest, chronological, easy to read, and fair accounts. What their influence is, I hard to measure.
And you've recently published a piece on 1 year into your paywall at Wired.
Yeah.
Were you kind of nervous about introducing that? I think, especially given the New Yorker success.
I wasn't that nervous. So I had worked at the New Yorker. I played my job had largely been about introducing the paywall, building a journalism model that would work with the paywall, working with the staff. There are all kinds of complexities. So the day I came into Wired and the day I introduced myself to the staff, I said, we're doing this. We set about doing it. There is no question in my mind that paid content is extremely important for a publication like Wired. From the day I got in the job, I wanted to do it as soon as possible. So I was 100% confident I wanted to do it. Was I 100% confident it would work? Of course not. My concerns are the same concerns anybody launching a paywall should have. So the general concerns, will you actually lose money, right? Because let's say you lose 10% of your traffic, you have been monetizing it at X, you lose a certain number of eyeballs, ad impressions, ad revenue, affiliate revenue, brand equity. So you lose money when you launch paywall because it will not increase traffic. It will most likely only decrease traffic. I mean, there's some weird ways it does increase traffic. As people subscribe, they feel more loyal and maybe more obliged to read. But in general, it's going to hurt your traffic. Two, it's possible that people are so used to getting your content for free. It's been for free for so long that there'll be some kind of a backlash. Three, we were a little late to the paywall party. And at some point, people will get subscription fatigue. And so I worried about that. I also worry, there have been times where there have been conversations on staff where people are like, well, I don't want to write that. That's going to, just get tons of traffic and not a lot of subscriptions. And I'm like, that's okay, right? We still get, the vast majority of our revenue from ad dollars. Like, just because we introduced a paywall doesn't mean that 90% of our revenue is from consumer revenue. It is still ad dollars. Like, we still need as many readers as we possibly can get.
You said as well that some of the pieces that drove the most subscriptions for you last year were quite a surprise.
Yes, that's true. So one of the things I did when I was writing that essay I wrote maybe 2 weeks ago about our year of the paywall, I looked at all the stories that had driven the most subscriptions. And if there's no precise science on what story makes somebody subscribe, because you read a story, you think it's great, you come back, you subscribe 3 days later, hard to track. But you approximate it. And the stories that did it were, of course, long, meaty features that got lots of readers. Not surprising. Of course, those will drive subscriptions. But there were also some stories that didn't get a lot of readers that drove a lot of subscriptions, right? So we ran this very dense piece called The Genius Neuroscientist Who'll Explain AI. And it got, I'd say, 140,000 readers, like not that many. I'd say it's the 65th most read thing on the site, but generated the second most subscriptions. That was interesting. Not that surprising, though. What was truly surprising was that we would run lists like, 17 best Mother Day's gifts. And they'd be good lists and good guides. And when they were done really well, they wouldn't just drive people to click on the story, they would also drive people to subscribe. And it turned out that in almost every category of content, the best stuff we published drove a bunch of subscriptions. So that was actually quite heartening and also a little surprising. Happy about that. Oh, and I should say, sorry, back to the question before of what I was worried about with the paywall. The other thing that I was worried about that was particular to Wired is that Wired has been very much associated with the notion that content on the internet should be free. In fact, we put the word free on our cover not that long ago, maybe 8 years ago. The predecessor of my predecessor wrote a book called Free, right? We come out of the Silicon Valley counterculture libertarianism. We come out of a philosophy where people in general have thought, well, information should be free, information should travel, don't put any walls around your information. So when we launched the paywall, I was very worried that a whole bunch of people who'd, loved Wired for 25 years were going to write to me and say, you're not only making this magazine impossible to read, you are destroying the ideals of the founders. And that turned out just not to happen at all. In fact, the founders said, oh, that's great. smart way to do it. Charge for your content. That's important. And everybody seemed to understand. There's almost no backlash against the paywall.
Well, I suppose people would always pay for the print magazine. So it's just right. The same thing in a different form.
People pay for the print magazine. And in fact, the founders wanted to set up a, premium, highly expensive print magazine. So all was well with that, though I did worry about it a lot.
But I guess the next big challenge for you guys is getting those people to resubscribe. So is there anything you're doing to prepare for that?
Well, we're trying to write good stories.
always helps.
My view is if they subscribe and if they get value from it, they'll resubscribe. And so if we do a good job, we publish lots of stories, we edit them well, if we send them out on newsletters in ways that are convenient, we reach the readers where they are on their devices or wherever they want to read them, they'll resubscribe. Yeah, so the resubscription challenge, I think, is just a be good challenge, which is exactly the kind of challenge you want.
And I know Condé Nast said that they eventually want to get paywalls across all of their brands. Do you think a paywall is something that can work for every brand, or is it just kind of specific audiences it really works for?
I think it can work for every Condé Nast brand. I don't think it can work for every brand. You know, if you are a traffic play, you know, if you run like you're, I mean, think about Forbes, right, which has this very lucrative contributor network. No one's going to subscribe to the contributor network, in part because there isn't really an identity or a style or a voice. Like, why would you subscribe to that? But it is extremely good business for them to be in. So there are lots of places where the subscription propensity will be extremely low, but the traffic will be extremely high, and it would never make economic sense to launch a paywall. There are other places where you can launch a paywall, set the meter extremely high, and pull in just a small number of people, but get some of the brand equity value of a paywall. And, you know, by setting the meter really high, identify an extremely core group of loyal users, you can then create some sort of membership program around. So there are all kinds of different models. The New Yorker and Wire, the two I know best, it's very much, we'll give you a couple things to read, and then we're going to hit you with a paywall pretty early on and get you to pay for us. But there are all sorts of other ways to have different kinds of paywalls that can work for different publications.
Yes, I suppose different kind of subscriber and membership schemes as well. And I know courts have just launched a paywall as well this week.
Yeah, they have, and they have a really interesting model, right? Where so the courts model is this combination where there's both a meter and there's some content that is only available to subscribers. Right, that was the big debate we had at The New Yorker, which is, should you gate some content or should you put a meter up, right? And if you do put a meter up, should you count some content differently from others? Right? Should you count a Larissa McFarquhar feature that took 9 months to write, you know, as 100 times as much as an Andy Borowitz story that he did in 7 minutes? Or should you count it the same? And the advantage of counting them differently is that you put more value on the thing that took more time. The advantage of doing it the same is that it's much simpler. The reader will never understand if you weigh things differently. So, you know, we had that debate at The New Yorker, we had that debate at Wired. Both cases, we resolved it to the side of counting everything the same. Quartz has done, I think it's the first publication I've seen, I'm sure it's been done by others, where it's, let's do both. Let's have some content that is the most valuable content we have, and you have to pay for it to get it, but let's also have a meter. I don't know how their meter works. I think it's a little opaque, probably deliberately. If you can have so that's another interesting trade-off, which I like, right? Do you have a clear meter so the reader understands, you know, oh, I have two stories left and maybe they're more likely to subscribe? Or do you have an opaque meter where you actually just put the paywall down when you think they're most likely to subscribe? So the problem with a clear thing is that if you know you have one story left, the meter might come down on a story that you're not likely to subscribe to. It might come down to a story you've just clicked into through Google that isn't a really high-value story. And you really want the meter to come down on the genius neuroscientist who explain AI story. So if you have an opaque meter, you can bring it down on the stories where people are going to have the strongest likelihood of subscribing. If you have a clear meter, it's just going to come down when it comes down. So that's another interesting trade-off.
I suppose you've got some of those AI paywalls that are coming in now that it varies for each person as to when they're most likely to subscribe. I've seen that.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would like, right? So my dream would be a paywall that can identify as much information about the reader as possible, right? So what, not just about the reader, but about their likelihood of subscribing. So are they in a place where they actually have some time, right? A reader on the subway is never going to subscribe because you have no time and you might lose your internet connection. You're never going to enter your credit card number, right? A reader on a mobile device is less likely than a reader on a desktop device. A reader who's just come in from Google probably doesn't even know what site they're on, so they're probably not going to subscribe. A reader who's come in from a newsletter who came in yesterday really does know what site they're on. The story they're reading has some effect on the propensity to subscribe. So if you could weigh the time of day, the day of the week, all these things have some propensity effect on your propensity to subscribe. If you could weigh all these factors, you could have a very efficient paywall. But it also, you know, give me 30 engineers and we'll build it. So what we've done instead is, you know what, we'll just do this simply.
And you just mentioned about newsletters there. You said that they're quite important in driving subscriptions. I read that you were launching newsletters in all sorts of different verticals and topics.
Yeah, so we have a regular Wired newsletter, which will say here are the 5 best stories we published today. But we also, in part because they do such a good job of driving subscriptions, are launching newsletters on different verticals. So here is a subscription for our gadget coverage. Here is a subscription for our, you know, coverage of the Mueller report. And we hope we can, you know, segment audiences, build, reach new people who don't want the Daily Wired email or who want both the Daily Wired email but don't open that, but will open our Mueller Report newsletter. We're experimenting with that. But it is definitely the case that newsletters are great for driving subscriptions.
Would you ever launch a paid newsletter?
Oh, yeah, definitely. If we had the right person and the right voice. So we had somebody, you know, if we had somebody who could write a daily newsletter that would feel essential to our readers, we would surely do that.
And I guess if you had to give one piece of advice to other publishers who might be eyeing up paywalls in the sort of great pivot we've had, what would that be?
Yeah, I mean, the most important curve to study is to study your engagement curve. And right, look at the percentage of your traffic that comes from people who read the story once. Look at the percentage of the traffic who comes from people who read two stories a month, the people who read three. And we'll have some kind of a downward slope. But at some point, the slope will start to smooth out. So, you know, at The New Yorker, it was very clear that if you read one story, you're probably not going to read two. If you read two, you're probably not going to read three. If you read three, you're probably not going to read four. But if you read four, you're going to read five. If you read five, you're going to read six. If you read six, you're going to read seven. So let's put the paywall there. And so finding the point on your curve where the slope changes is the right place to put a paywall.
And the last thing we ask all our guests is, what was the last thing you read or saw which really affected you?
The last thing I read, oh, that's a good question. Can I go with music?
You can.
Okay, great. So I was listening maybe a week ago to Amina Claudia Myers, who, piano player, singer, I listened to a fair amount, and I heard a song called Witchy Tainai, which I had never heard before. It just blew my mind, and I've been listening to it for a week straight. You know, one of the funny things about being in the in this job is, you know, you work so much, and you don't go out the way you did when you're in your 20s or even in your early 30s, and I have three little kids. And so when you're hit by a piece of art, it's truly wonderful.
Don't forget that we put out a weekly newsletter every Wednesday. It contains everything from links to the latest episode to links out to everything we've been reading and writing on the internet. And you can get that by signing up at voices.media, or occasionally we'll put out a link on our social channels.
And don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod, where we will also link to stuff. Particularly back to our website, where you can see the transcripts and the newsletter sign up and all the cool writey things that we do.
And obviously we do manage to get loads of cool guests ourselves, but if you know anybody who would make a really, really good guest, do get in touch. The contact details for us are on the website. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.